It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the new Irish food scene. Our guide is Anya von Bremsen of Travel and Leisure magazine. She says Irish food is a prime example of a country coming into its own new culinary identity. Anya's found the best of the restaurants, the pubs, and the inns. Jane and Michael Stern are in Oklahoma eating luscious onion burgers. Minimalist cook Mark Bittman has shortcuts to irresistible fish cakes. Our tea maven, Bill Waddington, has the scoop on teapots, and it's grape harvest time. So we talk to a winemaker about the crush. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure. A practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I want to talk about two seasoning tricks. Things you can do to bring out more flavor or new tastes in everyday cooking. The ingredients for them are in just about every supermarket. One is flavoring with greens, and the other is using olives the way you would use herbs. Let's begin with the idea of using distinctive tasting greens to make deeper, richer flavors in lots of different dishes, like roasted vegetables, stews, soups, and roasted meats or poultry. Now, you can use any green you have available, like Swiss chard or those organic salad mixes or radicchio or kale. The basic concept is that when you brown a small amount of chopped greens, their tart, assertive flavors deepen, and they become rich-tasting. They become a counterpoint to other foods. They make everything else taste bigger and bolder. And this is a great method for adding richness without adding any extra fat. Here's how it works. When you're browning vegetables at the beginning of a recipe, like for a soup or stew, add a handful of chopped greens. Now, when you're roasting something, let's say a cut-up chicken or just a variety of vegetables, you scatter some chopped greens in the pan. And they're going to add lots of depth as they roast. I'll give you an instance. I love cutting up peppers and roasting them with herbs and big wedges of onion. Add a big handful of tart greens, let them roast with the peppers until the greens are brown and crisp, and you get this meaty, robust contrast to the sweet peppers and onions. Now, for a great accent to poached or grilled fish, toss some coarsely chopped tart greens with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper, and then brown them in a sauté pan until they're crisp. Now, don't be shy here. You really want to get them brown. You do this over medium-high heat. You don't want to burn the greens, but you want to get them crunchy. Now, that's when their character kind of flips over into this combination of rich, deep, yet really tangy flavors. Serve them with the fish or top polenta with them. Now, for another flavoring trick, and this one's directly from Italy, but it's probably used wherever olives are grown, try using black olives as a seasoning. Talk about enriching flavors. Olives can do wonders. You can cook with olives three ways. Just remember one thing. They tend to be salty, so cut back on the salt in the rest of the recipe. If you want big, bold tastes, add about a third cup of great-tasting black olives to the dish, whether it's a roast or a stew, at the beginning of cooking. For more delicate taste, add the olives during the last 5 or 10 minutes of cooking. Say you're doing roast chicken. Roast 10 or 12 olives in the pan with the chicken and keep basting the bird with the pan juices. If you want to take that same dish and use olives in a delicate way, roast the chicken, finish it off, take it out of the pan, put the pan juices, in the pan obviously, over a burner, stir some olives into it, let it simmer a few minutes, and then spoon that sauce over the chicken. Now, in uncooked or slightly cooked dishes, good-tasting olives are the perfect contrast to high, bright flavors, you know, like the flavors from chilies or citrus juices or fresh herbs or vinegar. One great way of tasting this is in a classic Sicilian salad: fresh orange slices, fresh fennel, oil, vinegar, and black olives. It's gorgeous to look at, and it tastes great. Okay, so what kind of olives should you use? Well, always taste olives before buying. I like oil-cured black olives. Now, these are the ones that look shriveled. They're made by curing with salt, and then they're dried in the sun or in ovens. Always taste them for an iodine aftertaste. That's a flaw. And also, taste for too much salt. But if they taste good and meaty, buy them. If you can't get oil cured, go for easy-to-find Kalamatas from Greece or France's Nice olives. So try some new flavoring tricks and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicle. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and it's distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Today, we're going to Ireland with Anya von Bremsen. She's contributing editor to Travel and Leisure magazine. We've heard that the food has really changed in Ireland. Well, Anya's got the story. It's about how a country's flourishing economy and its renewed self-confidence have combined with great local ingredients to create a culinary revolution. Anya's been out in the Irish countryside checking out prime restaurants, pubs, and inns. She says that there is no better time to travel in Ireland than right now. Mark Bittman is back. Mark writes the minimalist column in the New York Times, and he's author of How to Cook Everything. He's always looking for smart shortcuts to good eating. Today, he takes on that restaurant darling, the crispy fish cake. Our tea expert, Bill Waddington, has the clues for shopping for teapots, along with introducing us to a pot that is a prime collector's item among Chinese tea lovers. The grape harvest has begun in California. Now, we want to know what really goes on right now at a vineyard and what are the biggest worries a winemaker has at this point. So we're going to get one on the phone and find out. Then, as always, in the second half of the show, we open the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. Jane and Michael Stern are on the road again. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we just found what may be the largest hamburger on earth.
Really?
It's in El Reno, Oklahoma, and Judith Thompson told us a little about it.
I was involved with the Main Street program from the beginning, and when we were trying to decide on a festival, because these burgers have always been cooked in El Reno, we decided that we would cook the world's largest hamburger.
I'm Debbie Harrison, director of the El Reno Main Street office, and the burger actually is 250 pounds of meat, 150 pounds of onions, and the bun itself weighs over 350 pounds. And then, of course, we use about 10 gallons of pickles and lots of mustard.
How does a person eat a 150-pound onion burger?
Well, that's very interesting. We found out that if we cut the ends out of tomato juice cans, they were just the right size to cut a hamburger.
Guys, does this happen every week in El Reno, Oklahoma, or is this something that they do, you know, once a year?
Lynn, don't be naive. They couldn't possibly do this every week. This is a once-a-year spectacular, but you know what it is kind of the ultimate extension of what El Reno, Oklahoma is known for, which is their tiny little onion burgers. El Reno, Oklahoma really is the fried onion burger burger capital of the world. And as little towns across America often do, to celebrate, they sort of take their minuscule thing and blow it up to gargantuan proportions once a year.
Well, now, wait a minute. It's not really minuscule. I mean, it's a normal size hamburger. And what it's called actually is an onion fried burger, which means that the onions get pressed into the raw meat as it fries. So they really become part of the patty. And the onion infuses the beef. You put it on a bun, a little mustard. It's a wonderful, simple meal. It used to be, this goes way back to the 1920s, it used to be that you could drive through El Reno, which is on Route 66, roll down the windows, and inhale nothing but onion burger.
You know, I say it's a little burger, and this is just Jane Stern sort of semiology here, because I divide the world into big fat hamburgers that look like softballs on buns and hamburgers that are cooked on a griddle and squished down very flat with a spatula. And that's the kind of burger served in El Reno. It's a normal sized hamburger, but it's nice and flat, which is frankly just the way I like them.
The idea of pressing the onion into the burger as it fries on the grill, I can taste that.
It's so good, and I don't know exactly what they do to the onion. We've tried this at home, and it never quite works out right. I don't know, maybe we don't have the seasoned grills that they do. The onions are extremely thin, almost translucent, so they're very malleable, and they get into the meat the way a thick slice of onion never could.
Probably the most famous place to eat an onion burger is at Johnny's in El Reno, Oklahoma, and it's a quarter of a pound of good Oklahoma beef that is, you know, squished with the squiggly onions onto the grill. And the grill man, Otis Bruce, told us that the meat is 81% lean, which I thought was kind of an interesting statistic. I'm not sure how he actually knows that extra 1%, but obviously making an El Reno onion burger has a lot more scientific panache to it than just slapping meat on a grill.
Not 80 and not 85, but
81%.
Hey, you two, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn. Bye-bye.
Happy eating.
On the road again, like a band of gypsies, we go down the highway. We're the best of friends, insisting that the world keep turning our way. And our way is on the road again. I just can't wait to get on the road again.
The Sterns, Jane and Michael, are the authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. You can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, and every week you can get their food finds on our website, splendidtable.org.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
bye, everybody.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1 is the author of How to Cook Everything, an ambitious title if there ever was one, and he writes the minimalist column for the New York Times. Now, what Mark does is he streamlines recipes. You see, it's not a real problem about shortcutting recipes. You just use prepackaged, prepared, or whatever. But Mark doesn't do that. Mark uses real food, and he manages to keep great taste. And that's why we keep having him back on the show. So, Mark, how are you?
Good. Thanks, Lynn.
So what have you been fooling around with lately?
I've been spending some time working on fish cakes, which for whatever reason is a long-standing obsession of mine. I really do love that combination of tender, flavorful fish in a crisp crust. And they're also great to make because, of course, you can use leftover fish to make them, so they're pretty easy.
So what's the trick to this? Because I have never really made what I consider to be an exceptional fish cake. What have you discovered?
Well, you need glue. You need some kind of glue.
Sure.
And, you know, Elmer's just doesn't cut it, and white bread doesn't cut it either. A lot of people use, you know, 50% white bread and 50% fish, and you see that in a lot of crab cakes. But there are a couple different kinds of glue you can use. One is there should be some egg. I mean, maybe instead of glue, we'll say binder. There should be some egg, and mashed potatoes often makes a very good binder, and much more flavorful than white bread, of course. But another option is to just use the refrigerator, and that is when fish, even plain white fish, gets cold enough, its natural gelatins chill to the point where they will bind the fish. So if you have half an hour, 60 minutes, or even 10 minutes in a freezer, mm-hmm. you can make a fish cake with almost nothing but fish, and it'll hold together long enough to cook.
What's the basic recipe then?
Well, there are two. And I have to say that my preference is for the mashed potato one, because I just love that. It, you know, sometimes blandness is really a plus. And if you combine bland fish with bland mashed potatoes, there's just something about this that's so homey. I mean, I would never use the term comfort food, but it's in that realm. It's so homey. And the basic thing is really 50% mashed potatoes, 50% cooked fish,
mm-hmm.
With an egg and whatever seasoning you want, obviously salt and pepper and scallion or parsley or bell pepper or whatever. And you cook that in oil, or if you're feeling adventurous, butter, until it's crisp on both sides. And because you started with cooked ingredients, you're not really worried about it cooking through. You just want to make sure the outside is crisp.
So you don't dip it in egg and roll it in breadcrumb or anything like that?
I don't really have much patience for that. I do sometimes dip it in breadcrumbs or flour, but not egg, and then not flour, then egg, then breadcrumbs,
uh-huh,
which I think is
uh-huh.
a big production and kind of a mess. The other option, as I said before, is much, much more fish and a little bit of egg and then chilling. And that's your basic crab cake, which, of course, is a variety of fish cake, is 90-95% crab with some egg, maybe a little mayonnaise or mustard for flavor, salt, pepper, again, scallion or parsley or bell peppers, or you can go in an Asian direction with other ingredients.
Uh-huh.
And that has to be chilled so that it holds together long enough to cook.
You know, this idea of the fish cake has become a big deal in upscale restaurants. Is this what they're using? I mean, what some of these chefs are using, the idea of the potatoes, or are there other tricks that they're doing?
Well, there are other tricks. And one is that shrimp is a really amazing binder. And if you puree or mince shrimp very finely, it has a very high percentage of natural gelatin in it and will bind almost anything. So if you combine cooked cod, for example, with some pureed shrimp, you'll get a nicely bound cake. Or what's done often in Tod Mun, which is the Thai cake made with bluefish or mackerel or Spanish mackerel,
mm-hmm.
is that that's almost pureed, and that helps it hold together also. I find that when you puree the fish, when you chop it very, very finely, and you, in order to get the binding that it is its most wonderful asset, you also create a fish cake that's a little on the rubbery side. And I really like more the very tender, flaky crab cake or white fish cake, with or without the mashed potatoes, that kind of falls apart when you touch it with a fork.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Chinese shrimp toast, which is
yeah.
really egg white and pureed shrimp and, I don't know, seasonings in it. And
you practically need a knife to cut it.
Yeah. Well, hey, we've got options here now. We've got the shrimp or pureeing of the fish. We've got the mashed potatoes. And then we've got the egg and the cold fish. Mark, this is good. Thank you.
I'm glad you like it, Lynn. Nice to be here. Take care.
Mark Bittman's column, The Minimalist, appears in the New York Times. He's author of How to Cook Everything. You can find Mark's recipe for fish cakes on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the food revolution in Ireland and travel tips for experiencing it firsthand. A tea expert talks buying teapots, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and your family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. You may have your doubts about this, but there evidently is a bona fide food revolution going on in Ireland. We keep hearing about great eating all over this little country. Evidently, Anya von Bremsen, one of the most intrepid seekers of great eating we know, has heard the same news. Anya writes about food for Travel and Leisure magazine, and she joins us every so often here on The Splendid Table. Anya, welcome back.
Thank you, Lynn.
Anya, look, I mean, Ireland has a lot of draws, but in the past, the food was never really one of them. So what's been happening there that's changed?
Well, it was a version of what's been happening in England for a long time because, of course, we all know that London is one of the great culinary capitals of Europe right now. And what has happened in Ireland is mainly economic prosperity. It's really, really flourishing. And also the proximity of London. So you have young Irish chefs who, instead of having to go and see the world, they can just go to London for the weekend and see what's going on there. And also you have a resurgence of great pride in their heritage and in their cuisine, and a combination of talent, money, and a very, very attractive, charming attitude towards food. So nothing is over the top. Nothing is in your face. This is not London. This is not New York. They make it very clear. So you have this very relaxed, but very skillful and focused cuisine that takes advantage of the incredible, incredible local ingredients. And that is the key.
Tell us some places to go. What are some of your favorites?
Oh, there's so many. Definitely the thing to do in Ireland is have a little tour of the bed and breakfast and, you know, the more stately manor houses, because that's where you're getting some of the best cuisine. One of my favorite is a place called Mustard Seed at Eco Lodge, and that's in County Limerick. And it's just this enchanting, enchanting little hotel full of antiques, done with impeccable taste, and it's surrounded by this lavish kitchen garden, and everything comes, all the vegetables, of course, are organic, all this lovely sort of north weather fruit that the chef uses in pies and jams. You have beautiful seafood that's intensely local, meat that comes from a butcher down the road. It's just this charming, sophisticated, but unstuffy experience that really characterizes Ireland for me right now.
What will the food be like on our plate?
The food at the Mustard Seed and at a lot of the Irish inns is ironically the kind of food that you expect to get in France and very rarely get. It's very lusty. It's very homey. It does use some of the traditional French techniques, but it's utterly unpretentious.
Hmm. What about good pub food?
Oh, that's been a real revolution, especially in Dublin, also in London. But for the real pub food, you have to go to this place called Moran's Oyster Cottage, and it's near Galway City. And it's a place that's famous for its oysters. They have an oyster festival. Oysters are something of a religion there. And it's this lovely, lovely thatch-roofed pub. It faces a little river with swans. And inside it's all dark and atmospheric, and there are huge pints of Guinness. And you essentially eat oysters, you eat crab. That's really, really sensational crab, one of the best crabs I've had. And just sort of barely prepared little salads, and maybe there's one or two desserts. And it's so convivial, and everyone is just so lovely. It's really not to be missed.
It sounds like a Hollywood movie set.
It is, and the funny thing is that it's not just a simple village pub. You know, you are likely to see Hollywood stars, and some, you know, when I was there were a gaggle of French film producers. So, but it's not, at the same time, it's not touristic. And that's what's happening in Ireland. That's why it's such a great time to go, because people are still welcoming, they're still friendly. You get this sort of buzz and energy, but it hasn't been ruined yet.
Oh, if you had to pick one restaurant to send me to, which one would it be?
There is a woman cooking in Cork called Mercy Fenton, and she cooks at a restaurant called Jacobs in the Mall, and it's a very modern sort of designed restaurant, and her cooking is very minimalist. When you look at it, there's nothing to do, you know, there's just a chicken leg with maybe some lentils and a salad, but her food has so much flavor, and it's so intelligent and just so lusty, and she uses organic produce, she uses the most incredible fish, but she doesn't have this California fetishistic attitude, oh, here's this wonderful beet, and you have to worship it. No, here's this wonderful beet, you know, just tuck in, eat it, and when you come into that restaurant, you just see the expression on people's faces, you know, they're just attacking this food. You can't keep away from it.
This sounds delicious. Is this your favorite place to go in Ireland, you think?
As restaurants go, yes, as independent restaurants. As far as inns, I would definitely recommend the Mustard Seed. And there's another place that's a real secret among Dubliners. It's called the Kilgrainy House, and it's County Wicklow, about an hour from Dublin. And it's the last thing that you expect to find in Ireland. Its owners lived in the Far East, in Southeast Asia, and it's something, it gives you the whiff of those exotic Aman resorts that you find all over Southeast Asia, because it's decorated with Southeast Asian flair. It's very minimalist, and the cooking is essentially fusion cooking using Irish ingredients, but it's just so stylish and so unexpected and so well priced. It's definitely a find.
So when you've you know, completely pigged out on the oysters and on all the produce, you go there for the fusion.
Then you have Irish salmon wrapped in nori. Yes. And serve a sushi right.
Anya, thank you.
Pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen is contributing editor to Travel and Leisure magazine, and she's author of Fiesta, a celebration of Latin hospitality. You can get Anya's Irish travel picks on our website at splendidtable.org.
When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys jeer for me, 'cause I never take where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
Our favorite tea authority, Bill Waddington, has joined us in the studio. Bill comes by from time to time to educate us about teas. Bill, hi.
Hi, Lynn. It's nice to be here.
Bill, every time you come, we ask you to bring something for us to taste.
Yep, you always want free samples.
That's exactly, yeah, right. Well, you know what? I figured we'd give you a break this time. There's something else I want to talk about, and it's not about tasting a tea. It's about what you make the tea in. I'd like to know about teapots, because there's a lot of different kinds out there. So when we go out to buy a teapot, what should we be looking for?
Okay. I think the first thing you have to look at is the functionality of the pot. How well does it work? And there are two factors to consider.
Uh-huh.
Number one, will that pot allow room for the leaf to totally expand as it's steeping? Because if it doesn't totally expand, and a leaf can expand 2 to 3 to 4 times in size, if it doesn't totally expand, you're not going to get the flavor out of the leaf.
Okay.
That's number one. Number two, you need a way to separate the leaf from the liquid when it's done steeping. It's too easy to just leave the leaf in the pot after you poured out your first cup.
Mm-hmm.
What remains in the pot will keep steeping and steeping and steeping and get so overbrewed and bitter that no one can taste it. So
right.
You need a way to separate the leaf from the pot. You need a way to allow the leaf to fully expand. And there's hundreds of different teapots out there that can do that effectively.
For instance?
The traditional Brown Betty teapot of an English tradition is kind of squat, round teapot.
And it's dark brown,
and traditionally
glazed china
exactly,
kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Works real well. It's been around 300 years at least at this stage of the game.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to get a pot like that, look for one with some weight to it. Also, look at the spout and make sure that the spout is as smooth as it possibly can, because chances are less likely that it'll drip on you.
All right. What about separating the leaves from the tea?
simplest way, and they've been doing it for 3,000 years, throw the leaves loose in a pot. When it's done steeping, use a household kitchen strainer to decant it into a second pot, and it works great.
Right.
And if you've got a household full of 5 dozen teapots, that's a nice way to show off a couple of pots at a time, too.
Mm-hmm.
Another simple way is to use some sort of a tea infuser that you drop into the teapot. I'm not talking about a tea ball, which you can buy at a discount store, but they tend to make lousy tea because they don't allow room for the leaf to expand.
And they open up.
And they tend to pop open as the leaf tries to expand, and you have loose tea all over the place. But some sort of a tea infuser. Usually it's a basket of some sort or another that'll fit inside the pot. They work great, and you just take them out when the tea's done steeping, so you don't have a problem with oversteeping at all.
What about these, like, they look like coffee makers, but they claim they make tea? You know, those electric things?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I think in theory they work sort of okay, but my biggest problem is they tend to be made by coffee makers. So you have a problem with the water temperature in them. Number one, they almost never, I've never seen one designed to actually produce boiling water, which is what black tea needs. And the other thing is there's no way to adjust the temperature. If you want to brew a green tea that requires barely steaming water, there's no way to adjust that temperature of the water in those electric tea makers to get the right temp.
How do you clean a teapot?
Traditionally, you don't clean a teapot. All you should do is to rinse it out thoroughly when you're done serving your tea for that particular day. The idea is that soap scum and even just soap residue will remain in the pot, and that's something you don't want in your next pot of tea. So just rinse it out real thoroughly, let it dry.
What about these glass pots and iron pots that I've seen?
They both can produce great tea, and the glass pots have the added factor of you get to watch the leaf unfurl, you get to see the tea brew, you get to see the colors, the reds, the greens, the yellows, which are just so dramatic. There's one disadvantage of glass pots, they tend to cool off a little bit quicker, so you need to be aware of that. The cast iron pots, the traditional Japanese tetsubin pots, make marvelous tea. They will hold tea hotter than anything else in the world. They're gorgeous to look at. They will last generations. They're great pots to make tea with, but they're an investment too.
Phil, I have been seeing these little tiny, they look like they're made out of unglazed terracotta teapots. They're very, very small. I mean, they look like the size of a teacup. What are these?
They're called Yijing ware. It's Y-I-X-I-N-G. They're traditionally handmade. They're from central China, from a particular region of central China that produces or that has deposits of a very special clay that's produced and found nowhere else in the world. Yijing clay.
Uh-huh.
They're traditionally handmade, and it is unglazed clay. It's exactly what it is. It's an unglazed pot. So the pot itself is somewhat porous, and it'll start to pick up the flavor of the teas that you steep in it over time. It's a pot you never want to ever put any kind of soap on. And you also want to dedicate a given pot to a given type of tea because it will start to pick up the flavor of those teas and start to influence the flavors in a real nice way over a long period of time. They're beautiful. They're works of art. They're fantastic.
They sound like collector's items.
They are indeed.
Phil, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
You can find tea expert Bill Waddington behind the counter at the Tea Source in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can find Bill's tea picks archived on our website, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can phone us at 800-537-5252 and we will talk. Anything you want to talk about, I'll give it a shot. Let's get right to the phones. We've got Tom on the line. So, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. My wife is reading a book. It's called The True History of Paradise by Margaret Cesar Thompson, and it's about the history of Jamaica and how Jamaica was established as a country and so forth. But it has lots of references to very unique foods, and one of them is called Marmite sandwiches. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Is it worth making?
In my humble opinion, no, but that's me. This is very British, and this must reflect the British influence on the island. What Marmite is this sort of yeast and vegetable extract. And if I remember correctly, and boy, the memory is dim, It comes in jars. It's like a paste. And you know what it's like? It's like a bouillon cube in the sense that you would make a broth from it. You might add it to things to enrich it. But if I remember correctly, in England, people spread it on bread and eat it as a sandwich. And it's a little much. I mean, imagine a pasty bouillon cube. It's sort of like a, you know, a protein source.
I see.
So Marmite sandwiches, there is a gastronomic experience that maybe you might want to sidestep.
Well, maybe we ought to try it just once.
You maybe want to do that. And it's something that a lot of people in Europe keep on their shelves, you know, to stir into the stew or enrich the soup or that kind of thing.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, may I ask you a second question?
Sure.
I'm always been curious, my wife and I have always been curious about when buying wine, how do you know what wine will age well? Is there a secret to that?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a secret to it. I guess one of the basics is if it has a screw cap, you don't bother. That's number one. And number two, though, generally speaking, the more robust reds might lend themselves to aging more readily. And the reason why you're hearing so much hesitation in my voice is I have a quick story to tell you in a moment about a white wine. But if you look at things like Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Bordeaux, Burgundies, a lot of these wines will lend themselves to being laid down in a cool place. You want things to be 50, 55 degrees, and you want steady temperature. You know, you want it to remain more or less the same through the year. And a place that doesn't have a lot of vibration, so you don't put it next to the oil burner, you know, in your basement if you have a house. And the idea is that you would lay it down. Now, the reason why I'm hesitating is it's a very complex subject, but one of the things is a lot of winemakers these days who used to make wines that lent themselves to aging are now realizing there's a big market for wines that are ready to drink almost as soon as they're bottled. But I would say if you look at Barolos, Zinfandels, Bordeaux, Burgundies, Cabernet Sauvignons, those kinds of things, you're pretty safe.
I see.
Okay. And, of course, the higher the quality. And the other thing is, take a look at some vintage charts. You know, Wine Spectator has them. Other publications have them. They're on the web. Because there are some vintages, some years, that were wonderful that you really you'd want to maybe buy it and lay it down for 3 or 4 years. Another that, you know, it was lousy wine to begin with. It's not going to get better. My quick story about white wines, there's always this business about you drink white wines as young as possible. Well, there was a wonderful wine writer in England named Harry Waugh. I think he has gone to that great tasting room in the sky at this point. But Harry Waugh, you could hate wine. You could have no interest in wine. You'd read Waugh and you'd be entertained. And he talked about how he wanted to learn about white Burgundies, you know, one of the great white wines, one of the great styles of wine in the world, and that he was told that there was this winemaker that he had to go an apprentice to, and he met this old man, and the first time he met him, the old man said, let me introduce you to what you're going to learn about. He went into his cellar, he brought up a bottle that was cool, it was a white Burgundy, they opened it, they tasted it, and it turned out they were drinking a 20-some-year-old wine.
Wow.
And Waugh said it tasted like spring. So some white wines certainly age well, and by the way, a lot of dessert wines age well. But the white wines, make sure they're the greats.
Well, that's great information.
Okay, Tom.
We'll have to try that with our Marmite sandwiches.
Yeah, well, great white Burgundy and Marmite. Boy, there's a combination that could really close the doors forever. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for our trivia question of the week. Now, this is the part of the show where we try to challenge your knowledge of arcane, fascinating, or just plain useless bits of food lore. This week's question is, if you're dining on the cutting edge in New York City, what's the big ingredient of the moment? We'll have that answer in a minute, get a winemaker's report on the grape crush in California, and take more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. It's open lines for your calls this hour at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It was, if you're dining on the cutting edge in New York City, what's the big ingredient of the moment? Well, it's salt. But used in ways you can't imagine. Chefs are blurring the line between the sweet and the savory parts of the menu. Salt is topping desserts, and believe it or not, with some surprisingly good results. And savory sweet cakes are showing up in the middle of the meal. The other news is the kind of salt. Now, this really goes over the top. We thought that the fleur de sel craze, you know, that special, and I should add really delicious sea salt that can sell for $30-some a pound, well, we thought that this was pushing the envelope. In a recent New York Times article, we learned that the city chefs are cooking with fleur de sel, but also with red salt, pink salt, black salt, and smoke salt. And the prices. Somebody has got to get a grip here. Try this on for size. Black lava salt and red clay salt, both from Hawaii, are each selling for $32 a pound. That's $2 an ounce. Then there's pink salt from Peru. This goes for $57 a pound. But the crowning glory is a smoked salt from Denmark. A pound of this gem costs a mere $84. Supposedly, it's glorious on salmon. Well, now you know, and now you know it may be worthwhile to empty the salt dish into your pocket the next time you eat in a fancy New York restaurant. You can use it as collateral on your next car loan. Okay, back to the phones. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We've got Charlie on the line. Charlie, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lynn, how are you? I love your show.
Oh, thank you.
I learned to cook from my mother, and she was born in China, although we're a Caucasian family, and then we grew up in Southeast Asia, so I know how to deal with all those sorts of spices, but she threw me a loop. My dad is a singer and went to sing in Central Europe this summer, and she brought back a bunch of saffron, and she brought back both mild and hot paprika. And since I learned how to cook in her kitchen, I have no idea what to do with these things.
Now, they were in Central Europe. They were in Hungary?
They were in Hungary as part of it, absolutely.
Oh, Lord. Well, the sweet and hot paprika is the pure gold or rose gold of Hungary. And think of this as rich, velvety-tasting chili.
Okay.
You know, not that you may be used to the family of flavors in chili where they dance and they're hot and they're citrusy.
Exactly.
And generally, the paprikas of Hungary come from these chilies. Most of the time, they're these heart-shaped chilies that I always think of as being the rich, lush, velvety, very sensual chilies of the chili world. And they're warm. They don't tingle and sting you as much as they kind of warm you and sneak up and go, whap.
Okay.
You know? So one of the classic combinations in Hungary is, and you might do this for stews or for soups, is that you saute, hope I'm remembering this correctly, onion and garlic, often with pork.
Okay.
Some kind of pork fat. Today you might want to substitute something else or use a small amount of pork fat, but like a little bit of really fine salt pork. And that might be pancetta. Even though it's from Italy, it's very much like good quality European salt pork. It's very rich. It's not overly salty. And you would saute that together, and once it's golden and brown, you would stir in the paprika, and you always saute it lightly. You don't want to burn it.
Okay.
It'll blossom. You'll smell
like,
it.
It's
open
just
up.
Like a Southeast Asian spice paste, then.
Exactly. The way you would do a
this makes sense to me.
Exactly. You fry it lightly. Then the other thing is, you said saffron?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is gold.
And she brought a pretty big-sized package of it, too. So actually, one of my questions was about storage. I assume since it was sort of a spice trade spice at some point, it probably holds up pretty well, but are there some better places or ways to store it and some others not? I haven't opened the packet yet.
I think the basic thing, and this would apply to the paprika. The paprika, there's debate. I've always kept paprika in the refrigerator.
Okay.
Some people say you shouldn't do it, but I think it's a very volatile spice, and it can sour quickly.
Okay.
So I've always stored airtight, like a Ziploc or something, in the fridge so it doesn't absorb odors. With the saffron, cool, room temperature, no light.
No light.
Is it the stems? Is it like little threads?
Yeah, it's the pistils in there. And, they usually say, recipe says like, five or six of those for something.
Because, that's the pistil of a form of crocus.
Yeah.
Most expensive spice by weight in the world. It's completely, has to still be processed by hand, which is one of the reasons it is so expensive.
Sure.
And the best way to use it usually, you know about saffron rice, adding some of it to rice dishes.
Sure.
But saffron has a very warm, appealingly medicinal. Medicinal usually is not an attractive thing, but it does have an appealingly medicinal quality to it, and a little goes a long way. It's a classic ingredient to risotto alla milanese.
Okay.
Without it, you don't make risotto alla milanese. Obviously, it's an ingredient to paella.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other places that it's used. For instance, it is used in India a great deal.
Yeah, I've seen it in curries before.
Exactly. Well, turmeric will color a curry usually.
Exactly.
But it might color a yogurt sauce.
Okay.
The other place you'll find it used is also in the Middle East and in North Africa. Logical, because these were part of the spice trade. These were the spice traders. And one of the things that I've done with it, it's a very ancient technique from the Renaissance. But what you do is you mix it with a very small amount of warm broth, so you make an intensely yellow liquid.
Uh-huh.
And then you whip into that a couple of egg yolks. And as you're roasting a chicken, and this would be what you would have at a Renaissance feast, except it might be a capon or a swan or a peacock, you keep, toward the end of cooking, you start brushing it with that mixture.
Oh, great.
And it's called endoring, from the word doro, meaning gold.
Sure.
And it's to burnish and turn something golden. It's festival food.
Now, would it, assuming with the risotto and the paella, which I thought of, it's absorbed through a liquid.
Yeah.
You want to put it in a hot liquid and then...
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And you'd stir it into a little bit of hot liquid, and some people strain out the threads. I don't. The stuff is too expensive. I'm not straining out anything.
And it seems to like then, could it work with like really fancy mashed potatoes or something like that?
Oh, it's wonderful. And you know the other place it's gorgeous? Sweet custards.
Oh, think that about, would make sense.
Rice
pudding or something.
Exactly. Your basic baked custard, very ancient. Again, we're going back to very old food.
Sure.
But now you're seeing, a lot of new restaurants, a lot of very sort of cutting-edge kind of cooking. You're finding saffron panna cotta, for instance.
Yeah.
Or saffron flan.
So the saffron flavor is extracted through a liquid.
That basically, yes.
And then the paprika through a little bit of gentle frying.
That's right.
Okay.
Exactly. Two techniques.
Well, now I know how to, go and play with it and have fun.
You're going to have a great time.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, Charlie. I have got the best way for eating that last ear of corn of summer. Forget the last rows of summer, guys. We people who like to eat, we know it's really important. There's a Mexican market in our town that has an outdoor stand where they roast the corn over a wood fire. Then they strip back, all the leaves around the ear of corn. And while it's hot, they brush it with hot melted butter. They roll it in sour cream. And then they dust it with grated cheese. And you have the option, when that is finished, which having it sprinkled with chili powder. I had it with, my husband had it without. As he said, A, it is a meal on a cob. B, he'd kill to eat it again. So, the last ear of corn of the summer, the last great sweet corn, hot, roasted over coals, melted butter, sour cream, grated cheese, and some chili powder if you want to. Robert's on the line. So, Robert, what do you want to talk about?
I bought a stainless steel stove and cooked some hot wings one night, and a little grease got onto it, and by the time I finished cooking, it had, varnished onto it. And I called Viking Professional, and they told me I could use Scotch-Brite and a soft scrub, and I asked them if that would scratch it, and they guaranteed me it wouldn't. Well, it did, and I still didn't get the grease off.
You know, stainless steel should be able to take a real beating. That's the whole idea behind it.
Uh-huh.
So what's the question? How to get that stuff off?
Yes.
Okay, I don't have a stainless steel stove, but I have got a restaurant-style range by Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And the only flaw is it has a black enamel surface,
mm-hmm.
and the thing is as delicate as a newborn babe.
Oh.
You can't use any of these real heavy-duty grease breaker kinds of things. So I'll tell you what I use on it.
Okay.
A paste of baking soda and water.
Really?
Yeah. And it doesn't scratch,
uh-huh.
and stuff that's been caked on and baked on and that kind of thing, it tends to remove it. I mean, it takes elbow grease, but it does remove it. And then you wipe it off with, you know, warm water, and that's it.
Okay.
But, you know, I have this real objection. What in heaven's name are we doing spending all these money for stoves when we have to baby the surfaces? Can you think of any other place in the house that gets the kind of beating a stove gets?
None. None. That's what I just can't understand, why the surface isn't more durable.
Well, I think we all have to start complaining.
Yeah. I mean, for $1,300, you would think.
For $1,300, I want somebody to come to the house and clean my stove for me.
Especially after them giving me bad advice.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the part that really got me.
Well, try the baking soda approach.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
All over the northern hemisphere, grapes are ripening, getting ready for harvest. We've heard the crush is on. So to get a first-hand report, we called Steve Beckman, a winemaker at Beckman Vineyards in Santa Barbara. Steve, hi.
Hi.
What exactly does this term, the crush, mean? Is this the actual crushing of the grapes?
That's where it actually came from. This is the time of year that we do our crushing of the grapes.
So right now you're actually picking the grapes, right?
We are actually picking some of the grapes. We make a lot of different types of wine, and they, thank God they do that, but they seem to ripen at different times. We'd be pretty slammed if we had to do everything in one day. But we've actually started this year on some white grapes already.
Now, I understand that there's a particularly perfect moment when you want to pick a grape. What is that moment, and how do you know it's happening?
Well, it's going to be something that's different every year. It's a combination when all the stars are aligned, I guess. when you get the optimum sugar, acid, maturity, and flavor in the grape. And it's too bad we can't just pick everything, you know, right at the exact moment, but we try and, you know, get as close as we can. But that's basically what it is, when all the sugar numbers look great and the flavor's there and you got good maturity in the grape itself and the skin and the seeds and the stem, all those things.
How do you know that? I mean, do you just go out and taste the grape, or
it's a matter of tasting and a little bit of chemical analysis.
And then once you pick, do you have to crush the grapes immediately, or do they wait?
I think it's probably ideal. You can have problems with grapes if they hang around for too long. In not good conditions, let's say it's warm, something like that. If you pick them and you cool them down, then they're probably good for a while. Everything that we do at Beckman is picked and then processed immediately, basically in the same day.
I know this is going to probably sound like a very silly question, but
we hear them all the time.
Well, well, here's one coming. Does anybody crush the grapes with their feet anymore?
We do a little bit. Of it, we use grape presses and all that stuff for white grapes, so there's really no physical contact with a white wine like a Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
The grapes are picked, they're brought into the winery, and they're put into the press. Whole cluster stems, everything. It's called whole cluster pressing. So we're not actually crushing the grapes, but we're just pressing them gently for their juice. Now, if you're making a red wine like Syrah or Cabernet Sauvignon or something like that, that's where you get a little of the crushing going on. We actually put the grapes through what's called a destemmer crusher, and we take all the grapes off the stalk or the stem, and they're crushed up a little bit. But I personally like a lot of whole berries in there, but that's just kind of my technique. But there is some crushing involved, and then they're put into fermenters, and they ferment, the red grapes ferment all in there with the must and the juice and everything, and that's how you get all your color and your flavor and your extraction. And that's why you have to make sure that every part of your grape is ripe. If you have, you know, good sugar number but you have green seeds, then that green character can add an off flavor or texture to your wine.
Huh. What right now is your biggest worry? What would be a winemaker's nightmare right now?
I think weather is a major concern at harvest time. And we want nice, warm days, not too hot, not too cold, something that will give us a very even and steady maturation and ripening.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get those days where it's really, really hot, and you might get a lot of sugar, but that doesn't mean you're necessarily getting the maturation of the other parts of the grape.
That's really interesting. So the sugar is not necessarily the key.
The sugar is one marker, sure. You want sugar because you're looking to make a wine with a certain amount of alcohol in it. So we want to get those sugars to make sure that we'll get that alcohol, which is normally not a problem most years. The last couple of years it's been more difficult because of the cool weather we've had in California. But this year it's been rather warm, and the harvest is more on schedule, let's say, than it has been the last couple of years.
Steve Beckman, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Steve Beckman is winemaker at his family's Beckman Vineyard in Santa Barbara, California. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Have a great week. Remember, though, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with an East Indian proverb. Garlic is as good as 10 mothers. Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials, 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional style heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you've heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Jennifer Russell and Sally Swift. Our associate producer is Jennifer Lubke. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.